Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. Hope you guys are all having a good week. I am jealous of my guest tonight. She, according to the bio here, unless she and her husband have moved, she's in Hawaii. And in the Midwest where I am, there's been some beautiful fall weather, but the wind turned to the north tonight, and it's got that nip in the air that foretells the coming of winter, which the older I get, the less tolerant I am of the extremes of heat and cold. And so I also was looking at the time difference. And as you know, we usually do Pacific, Mountain, Central, Eastern. My husband, before I knew him, was stationed in Hawaii. So he informed me, and she can see if he remembers correctly, that it should be about 4 o'clock in the afternoon where she's at, 9 o'clock where I'm at. So I'm jealous. I'm jealous. I haven't happened to be in Hawaii before. I talked to my husband about it, and for whatever reason, in the military, he did not enjoy his time there. He thought it was crowded. Wow. It's crowded a lot of places. I think that's a place, a different island maybe, that I'd like to try out. But I'm really excited about my guest tonight, Ezra Ogut, and her husband may or may not join us a little bit later. He's making dinner. Gotta love that man. And Ezra is author of a book called Money Does Grow on Trees, The Myths We Create and Live By. Now, I did want to say up front, and I don't usually use these press kits, but I do want to say this up front because this is not a book about, for example, the 9 steps to becoming wealthy, do this or do that to make yourself rich, how to close a deal, let me teach you how to meditate so all your financial problems will be over. There's a time and a place for that sort of thing. This isn't it. This book is about cultivating your prosperity consciousness, seeing how you are the one setting up your own limitations, finding the inner power to choose out the old reality and into the new, realizing tangibly the powerful creator you already are. Now, she talks about the law of attraction and manifestation, and one of the things, whether you're a person surviving from brain injury out there listening, or you're just 15 months into COVID and what I call my next book that'll be the 4 P's that brought me to my knees, and that's the protesting, politics, pandemic, and I have aging parents who've been going through a lot of transition the last year, and that's been difficult for all of us to deal with. And so you put all of that, all of those things together for the perfect storm all at once. And we're seeing things like in August, 4,300,000 people quit their job. And they quit, the government quit giving unemployment and money out like candy about 4 months ago, I believe. So what are these people doing? There's nothing like a crisis that happens along our journey in life that winds up being cathartic. And all of this that's been going on in the last 15 months at least has probably added a lot more people to the mindful category of looking at, is where I'm standing today where I would want to have been for the rest of my life if I knew my life was going to end? Am I doing my life in a rote sort of fashion? And is there something I have the power to do to change that and to create a renewed purpose and reimagine my life in a way that makes me happier than I ever could have imagined and attract all types of abundance to me? That's what Ezra and I are going to talk about. I did things a little backwards tonight. I'm going to bring her on in just one moment. But for those of you who are new around here, just to give you a little background real quick, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. And for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. If you want to know more about me, you can find me at inaflash.org. And I'm going to be mentioning a number of times during the show. And for those of you who aren't new around here, I post in about 40 places all over social media. You can also find the show braininjuryradio.com or at my inaflash.org site. And I always put my guests' website. So if you're driving or you're in the recliner and you're not by a pen, don't panic and jump up and do what I did and break your foot by moving too fast and tripping. Gosh, I was the poster child for 2 months ago, and I'm still working on it, for the most of the accidents happen around home crowd. But in any case, her website, IkeandEzraNow.com, we'll be mentioning it, like I said, a couple of times during the show, and it's always written in my program notes, so you can go back and find it. As a transformational coach and yoga teacher, Ezra B. Ogut has helped people worldwide discover their power to live the life they choose. Today, she helps people transform their lives to experience their own spiritual and financial abundance through one-on-one coaching and workshops. Individuals, celebrities, and corporations have all sought her services and mentorship. Along with her husband and business partner, author, and transformational coach, Ike Ogut, Ezra pioneered transformational coaching in Turkey and co-created a sought-after coaching certification program. She holds a bachelor's degree in English literature from Turkey's Bosphorus University and a film and television certificate from UCLA, and is a certified instructor of Kundalini Yoga. Ezra currently resides with her husband, as I said, in Kauai, where they work online to train coaches around the world while continuing to write Money Does Grow on Trees, which is Ezra's first book in English. With that, I'm going to bring her on now. Ezra, how you doing this afternoon in your case?
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on. And very, very intuitive of you, Kim, because you did say, I don't know if she's still in Hawaii. Actually, just a month and a half ago, we moved back to L.A. So I am not that much in the afternoon right now.
Oh, okay. Well, then you're seven-ish, a little after seven, I guess.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Do you mind if I ask why you left? You know what I say to my husband, you know what I'm talking about, his experience there. I'm asking people all the time, why did you leave Hawaii? And it's only because I'm here in Omaha, Nebraska. and I've been to L.A., okay? I have not been to Hawaii, but I wouldn't trade Omaha for L.A., for example. not my thing. Now, Big Sur, maybe, Carmel, Monterey, although I don't even know, you know, from what I see politically and otherwise, if I'd even want to go that direction right now,
yeah.
If it's even the same place that I remember fondly. I would hate to go to some place I remember fondly and see it ruined from my memory. From my memory.
Exactly,
okay.
What
it's been quite a while since I've been there, but I mean there was no threat. It was beautiful. It was artsy. You know, everybody was kind of hanging loose you know, things weren't so tense, and it just seems like now there'd be more people going a different direction, at least. I don't know if you watch the news and talk to too many people from your area, but what brought you back to the mainland?
Well, I mean, Kauai is definitely like heaven on earth. It's just so incredibly beautiful. Every time you get out of the house, you just look around and you just like have a wow moment, like, and it just doesn't get old. But, you know, there's something called island fever. Being on a rock in the middle of the ocean after a while can kind of really get a little bit claustrophobic. Life is very slow. Everything is very slow. And you're so busy, you know, staring at the rainbows and the sunsets that you just don't feel like working at all. So it's a wonderful place for vacationing, for sure. But in terms of living, you know, after a while we started missing, you know, action, something cultural, going to the movies. There's not even a movie theater in Kauai. It's a little different than Oahu. Definitely not crowded, and definitely we had the best of the island during COVID because nobody was really allowed to come in unless they, you know, stayed in a hotel in a room for 14 days, so people really stopped coming. And
right.
But, yeah, it was just time. It was time, and L.A., you know, I've lived my entire life traveling. Every 4 years, I've lived in a different country since I was born, and interestingly enough, although I'm Turkish in essence, L.A. is the longest place I've ever lived in. So it kind of has that home feeling for me, yeah.
Wow, really? I'd love to know what Turkey's like. You know, there's a couple things that are just slightly off topic about your book, but I'm interested because I read about how much you traveled. Let's see, you went to six. By the time you graduated from college, you had lived and attended schools in 6 different countries spanning 3 separate continents. And then, well, I'm going to stop and ask that question first, and then we're going to back up and do the actual interview. But I'm interested in your perspective, because you're entitled to have one with all the travel, you know, and the cultural differences and the countries that you've been to, regardless, you know, of the amount of time. You lived in all of them for some amount of time. And
yeah, usually 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, yeah. And you talked about coming here, being an ardent lover of freedom of thought and speech, that's
yep.
kind of what made you come here in the first place, leave the security of your friends, your family, and Turkey, if that's where you were living at the time, or any one of the other countries, and decide to make the big leap to a country you had never been to before. And then it sounds like you went to one of the biggest cities, you know, one of the few biggest cities in the country is your first place to come to this country. So I guess, you know, with me being a homegrown of this country and of this city, as a matter of fact, so a lot different. I've traveled a lot, but never lived elsewhere. I'm kind of wondering what you think about what I see, I guess, right now.
Well,
are some
yeah.
challenges in the freedom of thought and speech. There's people walking on eggshells, afraid to utilize that freedom of thought and speech that it's always been our birthright. And I'm no spring chicken. So, you know, half a century plus, we've always had freedom of speech and freedom of thought. And, you know, people, obviously, we're not the Stepford country. People are very different and diverse in their thinking and their ideas. But I remember most of my life that people were able to have a conversation about something, and whatever drew them together, whatever energy drew them together in the first place, whether it was because they were family, friends, acquaintances, workmates, whatever, just someone that you had energy with that maybe you passed on the beach. You could sit down and have a conversation about something, and if you got on one of those controversial topics, like something that was political or religious or whatever, and you disagreed, you might carry on your different points of view for a little bit, but then when you could clearly see that nobody was going to change anyone's mind and this was wading into some deeper water, what people usually did was stop, reroute, and talk about that beautiful rainbow, you know, or what a beautiful day it is today, and then use that as a conduit to switch to a more neutral topic, and the relationships would move forward, and you just would know not to visit that particular neighborhood of the mind with that person. And I've got to tell you, in my lifetime here in this country, I have never seen what I have seen the last year, let's say, maybe even a little bit longer, of people when they disagree being like rabid animals that won't let go of their point of view and stop and listen or have a willingness or an open-mindedness not only to hear what the other person has to say, but to still like that person and continue a relationship with them, even if 100% of their views don't match up. It's a real anomaly to me in all my years to see this kind of thing going on so frequently now in the hostility that's going along with it. That's just not the way that it's typically been here. And then the censorship with social media and the news and schools, you know, we're hearing about that and getting labeled a domestic terrorist if you happen to disagree with whatever, you know, the current point of view is, whether it's about school, masks, vaccines, whatever the topic might be, which is pretty drastic. You know, we're Americans here. We're all Americans here. And we all, if we trace our genealogy back, we're all immigrants from somewhere here. You know, and yet we're all Americans, but suddenly that's like, it feels like we're, not like we're turning on each other, but like we're being led to turn on each other instead of being the United States that I've always been very proud to be part of. Have I thought it was perfect? No. Is there anywhere I would trade? No. Is there always room for improvement? Yes. Are there places that need a heck of a lot more improvement than here? Yes. That's why everybody's coming. But I just wonder how you feel about that, having been here, you know, traveled around, gone to the island, come back here. Have you noticed a difference from when you
Big difference. I mean, it's been actually pretty excruciating for both me and my husband because, like me, we sacrificed a lot to come and live the American dream. And we did get to have the American dream, but, you know, that, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, democracy, all these different people from different backgrounds, like living together, letting that variety create like so much interesting colors in one country. This was a dream for us. And to be a part of this dream, both of us, we didn't know each other at the time, but left very prominent jobs and, you know, options just to live the American dream. And it took a long time to get our citizenship, not having paperwork, having to do all kinds of jobs just to eat or just to pay rent. And it was really all for the love of the freedom of America. And that is unfortunately, you know, recently getting completely reversed. We both feel like everything we escaped, you know, Turkey for is now happening here. Mm-hmm. And actually Turkey's gotten much better in the meantime, you know, so there's this incredible reversal going on. And, you know, Americans in a lot of ways when, you know, you haven't, because it's a country far away from all the other countries, there's an ocean that separates everything. And when you haven't seen other cultures, sometimes you don't know the treasures that you're holding in your hands. And if it's just been given to you by your ancestors, you know, who fought for it, well, by the time it comes around to you, it's possible that, you know, people take it for granted because they haven't seen what it's like not to have it. So sometimes, you know, the way I like to look at it is that we need to go into contrast in order to get re-clear and make new choices about, you know, what kind of an individual life we're going to have, what kind of a society life we're going to have. But freedom of thought, freedom of speech, and you are innocent till proven guilty, these main, to me, pillars of, you know, American Constitution and democracy are definitely, in terms of practice, completely out the window. And, you know, and I think people think that democracy is like a system. No, democracy is a vibration. And it's a very high vibration. There are people who measure, you know, these vibrations. I think David Hawkins is one of them. Frederick Dodson has a wonderful kind of a scale of like measuring, you know, you can actually measure the energy of something. And democracy is vibrating in the high 400s, whereas the frequency of the average frequency of the planet is around like 200, between 200 and 250. So to live a democracy and 400 frequency is all about what you were talking about, Kim. It's that understanding of, you know what, you're okay, I'm okay. You win,
yeah.
I win. You know?
Yeah.
It's great to disagree in democracy and in the frequency 400 because that disagreement is what opens up the mind to, let's say, find a third solution that hasn't even been thought before. It's that contrast that gives birth to more. And when there's no permission for that, and everyone is just like on eggshells, as you said, not afraid to speak their truth, getting attacked if they speak their truth, it's very, very sad to see.
It really is. And
yeah.
Go ahead, keep going. The reason I'm asking you, because you are a great person to ask. You know, I can talk to another American about it, and it's not the
yeah.
same as someone who's actually experienced all of the travel, living in the different countries, the different continents, hailing from Turkey and coming here with a dream. And you know, when you talked about immigration and what you went through to go through, and I don't say that our immigration system can't stand some tweaking, it can, but throwing the baby out with the wash and eliminating the borders, I'm against. I don't have a problem speaking my truth. And I'll probably be labeled, you know, the FBI is listening to our show now. So when we talk about abundance, you know, we're not domestic terrorists. We're just people having a conversation. But, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's just craziness to me because, anyway, about the immigration, what I was going to say is I'm a member, and you may not be familiar with this, but there's an old, I think 1894 is maybe when this organization was founded, but it was called Daughters of the American Revolution. And I'm a member, and what we've done to become a member is actually traced our family tree back, and not loosely. These are some tough-nosed ladies in women in Washington, D.C., not by family stories, not by happenstance, but by finding birth, marriage, and death certificates all the way back to someone that we call a patriot who fought in the American Revolution. And so it's genealogy with proof back to the revolution. And then some of us have gone beyond. I originally thought I was Irish and Italian. It turns out I am. But, you know, the boundaries were a little different back in the beginning. And so there's a little Greek with the Irish, and there's some Scottish, and then some Viking along with the Irish. But one of the things in Daughters of the American Revolution that we do, or one of the activities that I've been involved with, is immigration. And that's actually going to the immigration ceremony. And so I get to see the people in the courtroom who in a few minutes are going to be new citizens. I know what they've been through to become a citizen, how hard they've worked to become a citizen. And after whoever the president is at the time does a thing on a TV screen and the judge makes a speech, then, you know, people come and the judge shakes their hand. Immigration gives them their certificate of citizenship. And then I'm the next person to shake their hand and hand them an American flag, along with a care and code to the American flag. And then the next place they go is to voter registration. And the people that I've seen with tears in their eyes and such overwhelming pride that they set a goal that wasn't easy. It took a lot of work, a lot of frustration. But again, anything worth having, worth working for, right? You appreciate it more. You talked about, you know, especially the young people, they've never known anything different in this country. So it's easy to pick things apart because they have no basis of comparison.
Exactly.
And some of the people that are coming are not working for it. You know, they're not working for it. They're just coming. And so they're taking certain things for granted too and not having the same kind of appreciation in a lot of cases or gratitude to be able to have set a goal, gone through the steps, and accomplished that goal and empowered themselves to come here for what we always stood for and had promised. And so I was just very interested in what you thought and your opinion, because people should hear it.
I think one of the most kind of toxic things that is happening is that there's a lot of rewarding of the victim psychology that's going on. And, you know, one of the first things that my mentor taught me when I started that enabled me to change my life from kind of, you know, being a shoe sales girl to creating a $1 million business, whether it was about prosperity, whether it was finding the love of my life and having a great life with him, just many, many things. I mean, the subject can go on and on. But his main training of me was never to come from or give allowance to the victim psychology. And by victim psychology, it's very, and we all fall into it for different reasons, you know, regarding different subjects, but it's very easy to catch ourselves if we're doing any of the three things I'm going to just mention right now. A, if we're complaining. B, if we're blaming. And the blame can be other people, or it could be blaming ourselves. It doesn't matter which direction the blame goes. C, if we're defending the problem. Now,
yes.
Out of that victim psychology, no solutions can be born. So even if we fall into that victim psychology, and this could be in regards to America, it could be in regards to, you know, whatever, women's rights. It could be in regards to prejudice. It could be in regards to anything you can think about. The subject doesn't matter. But if we're, like, falling into the, you know, into that ball of feeling like a victim, at least we shouldn't try to look for a solution, because the solution vibration and the victim vibration, there's no way they cancel each other out. They cannot coexist.
Right.
It's like you're either pregnant or you're not pregnant. You cannot be both at the same time.
Very good analogy. Yes, I agree. I agree. Well, and again, why I'm interested, and we'll drop back to the interview, but that too is something that I noticed in my own life personally. A lot of what you talk about really resonates with me, and the trending of a lot of people like yourself that are thinking along the lines of abundance in a different way than we traditionally thought about it, like what I read at the beginning off of your press kit, and how being able to transform and empower. And, you know, I was talking to my husband the other night, and we were talking about the victim mentality, because different group all were talking about their victim mentality. And then I said, you know, I come from, you know, this race, this place. I should be according to what's going on now, one of those people that is apologizing. And then I cited to him some things, and you have some here too, that I went through in my younger days that were definitely victim material.
Mm.
And if I wouldn't have gotten over, not gotten over it, worked through it and came to a place where I fought to get out of that victim mentality and to get empowered and find my inner strength so I could move forward and not be angry, bitter, depressed, hateful, an addict, an alcoholic,
yeah,
perhaps suicidal, then I was going to have to do things that got me out of that victim mindset, or I was going to alienate everyone in my life and me from myself. And that's no way to live life. That's why, you know, I'm sitting here these days just shaking my head going, wow, you know, have I gotten that old, or has this country gotten that stupid, you know, that they're not playing the tape all the way, play the tape all the way through, you know, is something a mentor of mine told me a long time ago, you know, before you just act. And that's, you know, happened recently on some pretty big things where, you know, they've just acted and haven't thought through, you know, played the tape through to the end at what those consequences and what those vibrations were going to be. And it wasn't going to accomplish what they hoped. It was going to shoot them in the foot and actually
exactly.
set them back. And the frequency of that just blows me away. And I don't know. I don't know why. I'm just happy. You know, when he and I were talking the other night, I said we were talking about school kids, and I just said, you know, it's so hard to be prepubescent in this world. I don't know about Turkey, but here, you know, anywhere, I think hormones and just trying to get your initial autonomy from being part of the family to figuring out who you are as an individual, that's hard enough. If you have to, right out of the box, apologize for something you had no control over, where you were born, how you were born, how you grew up, you know, really it's about the kind of person you are and the service to yourself, the service to others. I can't imagine drowning, sorry, I guess that goes back to your story and we're going to get to that, but our youth who are already going through a challenging time and make them feel anything less than proud to be Americans and mm-hmm. proud to be who they are, no matter what color or sex or whatever, whoever they are, they need to be able to be proud of their country, proud of themselves, and not start out being trained and indoctrinated into being victims. That is going to set a course that's going to be very hard to reverse going down the road for the rest of their life, and that just makes me sick. I can observe it at my age and self-correct. Kids can't do that. You know, they, yeah. I mean, depending,
well,
you know,
I,
because
I
if they're...
They can, because I think, you know, I, having worked with many people, also, you know, looking at my journey, at my husband's journey, you know, kids, I mean, they're kind of like fresh from the other side. So in so many ways, they're like way beyond us grown-ups that have been on the planet maybe too long. Their intuition is great. And just because something, they're experiencing something, it doesn't mean they're necessarily going to buy into it. they could make a decision to, you know, from, again, the contrast, newness is born. So they can make many decisions that is then going to set the course to be better. I mean, I think, like, America maybe needed to experience this contrast, you know, lose some of the treasures that was, like, taken for granted that the rest of the world, like, really looked up to before they could really understand how important it is to hold those principles in place and not just hold them, not take them for granted, but to live by them. And, you know, we're all going to have excesses. I mean, I experienced prejudice when I was 8. And, you know, coming from a Muslim country and then not speaking the language and then being in Greece, you know, where Greek and Turkey politically are always, like, at each other's throats. And I experienced extreme prejudice. I couldn't speak the, you know, I was in a British school. I didn't know the language. So I didn't know even what on earth was going on. But all the kids hated me. Like, they would touch me, you know, by mistake, and they'd be like, ew, like that. And I'm like, oh, my God, what is going on in my reality? It was just absolutely traumatizing because I couldn't understand what was going on. And then later, when I did learn the English, I realized that the most, I'll never forget her name because we became very good friends after the fact, but Sophia, which ironically means wisdom, the most popular girl in school, had told everyone in school that I'm Turkish and that Turks steal and eat babies.
So
as an 8-year-old, this is like everybody thought, I guess my parents are at home busy eating, you know, kidnapping and eating children. So that's why there was all this, like, kind of mass hatred going on, you know. And as soon as I learned the language, I, you know, was able to express that's not the case. And we ended up becoming very good friends. But very early on, because of this extreme experience, I learned and understood how someone who is being prejudiced towards you is not even about you. It's about the kind of conditioning they've had come through their ancestors. That moment, I could totally see the innocence of Sophia, and then through via her, the innocence of the whole school. And then the problem, you know, although it was a hard journey, it was overcome. And that understanding, the place that consciousness of understanding got me is that after that point, after I had that, let's say, how do you call it, in a ritual, you know, when you transform all of a sudden, you go through that dark passage to learn a lesson of some kind. After that moment, you know, I traveled the world as a Turk, you know, as a woman. I never again experienced prejudice because I didn't see it as something that's threatening or that is something even about me. But then there's other limiting beliefs
Right.
I had about myself. You know, for example, oh, I'm not good enough, or, you know, oh, I can't be good at this, or I can't succeed in that. And as long as I held to those belief systems for the duration of the time I did believe it, that's how I experienced my reality. Not because it had to be true, but because these were belief systems that I was holding on to. So it's very, very important. I mean, it doesn't mean things are not happening from the outside to us, but what we meet up with, what kind of events we have happening. You know, when we're dancing with these, who dances with what portion of this is not like pure coincidence.
Right.
There's
right.
like a vibrational kind of crisscrossing that's happening. So that was, to me, a very early lesson since you asked about, like, you know, moving from culture to culture. Like, for me, it wasn't just moving from country to country, but it was moving from east to west and west to east, which are very different kind of, you know, thought patterns. And then the second aha I had that I want to tie into abundance is, you know, I was just struggling with finances, like ever since I could remember. And when my mentor, for the first time, you know, thought of asking me, he's like, well, Estra, you know, if I were to say to you, you're creating your own reality, what would you say? And I was like, well, I'd say you're crazy because I really want to be making, you know, money. And so how am I creating something, you know, the opposite of what I want? And
right.
he asked me to kind of go back and reflect to the first moment I had a relationship with money. if I could remember that. And when I did, I went back to a 7-year-old version of myself. And there's like some grown-ups are talking, and they're talking about like a woman who got married to a super rich guy, and they're like, oh, that's what women should do. You know, love is something stupid anyway. Only stupid women follow, you know, love. And I'm only 7 or 8 hearing this. And I could have gone in that direction. And that's what I mean. As children, it doesn't, you know, rather than what's happening around us, what's more important is what are we choosing out of what's happening around us. So hearing this conversation as a 7-year-old, I get very upset. And mm-hmm. I can't say anything, you know, because they're the grown-ups and they're not going to listen to me. So I go, you know, to the bathroom. I look at the window, into the mirror, and I make a declaration, which became my belief system. And I said, I will always follow the way of love, and I will never, ever follow money. So in my reality, I split love and money apart from each other as if the two cannot coexist. And up until I woke up to this story, exactly as I had encoded myself, you can think of it as these choices we make early on regarding a myriad of different subjects. We can think of it as like, you know, we're the programmer. We're programming it into the computer. Ego is the memory, the database that's held there. And then the screen of the computer is the life that's playing out in front of our faces. And it has very much to do with the choices and the beliefs that we carry around until we're done with that script and we, you know, wake up from that illusion, write a new script, and then begin to experience now the new program that we're choosing.
Perfect. Now I think we will... I appreciate all of that, and I think that's going to tie in well with the interview that we were going to do, because right here I'll say that a lot of our listeners have gone through game-changing health events. I'll use me for a quick example. This is Brain Injury Radio Network. There are people who have had brain injuries of all different kinds, be it a car accident from domestic abuse, a stroke, an aneurysm, a brain tumor, whatever it might be, along with caregivers. And now that we've been on air, let's see, I've been here almost 11 years every week, and our network's been here 13 years. There's a lot of medical professionals that also listen to the show, and just people in general, because everyone's heard of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, but there's 2.5 million brain injuries every year. And if you were to go out on the street and ask people what they knew about brain injury, they don't know a lot about brain injury. The survivors don't know a lot about brain injury. The medical profession saves our life, which is key, but then a lot of us walk away with residuals, and there's no point person at the point, you know, at the point the surgeon, for example, saves our life and then releases us. We have these residual issues to deal with, and there isn't anybody that deals with that. You might go to a shrink, you might go to a neurologist, you might, what most of us have done, and we'll be talking about yoga a little bit later, is we've tried going down what I call the traditional medical model, and a lot of us have gotten frustrated with that and found it to not be helpful in the way that we need it to be. And so through shows like this, we've heard of different means of healing and adjusting our attitude and rewriting our script, as you put it. Now, I'm a ways out from my injury, but I was a financial consultant for almost 30 years. And when I had my injury, I couldn't go back and do what I was doing before. I had a lot to to lose because of licensure and liability and all of that when my short-term memory was damaged. It was too big of a risk to take. And so I went through what I call the tweener stage, and we're going to be talking about that in a different way. But that's where, for the longest time, you try to hold on to where you can't go back, you know, wishful thinking, you know. It's the only thing you know, too, whether it was good or bad, you know. You crave being able to go back to what's familiar, and then you look ahead, and it's like a dark tunnel, and you don't know where that leads or what your options are, and so you stand in this tweener stage, not being able to move forward yet, not being able to move back, but in this place where you're going to make key decisions that are going to dictate the way moving forward is going to look. And that's where I like to address messages of hope and the people listening out there that think because their life changed or wasn't what they wanted or expected, that they can't be happy, that they can't find purpose, that they can't redesign, reimagine their needs, wants, and desires. And to have a different, I heard someone the other day who's in a position of moving, and it's out of need, not desire. And she said, I hate this place, and it's actually a very nice place, okay? I hate this place. I am always going to hate this place. It's never going to be home. And I said, you know, that's true. Every day, every minute, for the rest of the time you're on this earth, that is going to be the truth, your truth, if you let it. Do you realize that you have choice over that? Complete choice over that, how you choose to look at it. Do you want to spend every minute of every day for the rest of your life in this negative, dark place? Or do you want to adjust your attitude and see all the good? You know, you're letting go of some things that are good, but there was also some things less than good in that situation. Now, you know, the new place doesn't have some of what the old place has that you loved so much, but it's also got some advantages that weren't afforded you at the last place. But that's right now, perhaps because of grief. My guess, maybe, you know, I don't know, I'm not a mind reader, but perhaps because of grief, you know, they're hanging on to the negative aspect and not willingly, I use an acronym, HOW, honest, open-minded, and willing, the HOW. And she's not in the how right now at all, you know, at all, and is really miserable. And so, you know, she wasn't ready to hear what I was saying. And I get that, you know, people are ready when people are ready, if they're ever ready. But it's unfortunate that, you know, you don't have to be unhappy and negative and dark. It is a choice, and people often don't understand the power that they have to be able to change their attitude and their outlook. But going back to your book for a moment, why we've been talking a lot about the current time and what's going on at the current time. I think any time, your book is a great premise to live by. But right now we're being challenged on so many levels that we weren't before, that we're putting that on top of all of the status quo challenges that people go through in their life when all these other things aren't going on. Why do you think your book is especially important in our current time?
You know, Kim, that's a great question. I didn't write the book for these times because I actually finished the book March 2020, just before the whole explosion of the COVID. But I was writing it, it just finished as the COVID, you know, just kind of exploded onto the scene. And but while I was writing it, you know, I'm always so moved by the clients we have in the certification program that lasts like for a year. So we're coaching them pretty much on a, almost like a daily basis for about a year. And the amount of kind of changes that happen in their lives, sometimes it's about health and healing, physical healing. Sometimes it's like beginning their own business. You know, we don't have in that sense like a niche, you know, subject. It's more kind of a universal thing. And they inspire me so much. In some cases, their journeys are way better and faster than me and my husband were. So they're such an inspiration back. And I wanted to capture even if just a slice of that in the book. And my whole intention while writing it was to empower people, by getting them to look at themselves, by getting themselves to, you know, do the exercises and discover some of the stuff that may be limiting their reality. And so I think that's important. I mean, it just happens to be important for now because of all the challenges we're all going through. But I think it's just universally, you know, important to realize that we are the solution. We have a solution to every problem. Has a solution, and it lies in our own wisdom. And when we can touch that wisdom, for example, when something awful happens to us, which is not what we wanted, not what we expected, of course there's going to be negative emotion, you know, for a while. But after we've traveled in that journey to turn around and ask ourselves, because only our consciousness knows, what is the gift that I can get situation right now? And it sounds maybe very basic, but actually when you do it with sincerity and when you do connect to that incredible wisdom that lies inside each and every one of us, the kind of answers and the solutions that come are not just an inspiration for that person, but then like in your example, through what you went and how you overcame it, then that becomes such an inspiration to so many others because we don't experience anything just coincidentally. Sometimes I believe it's kind of a journey that we've, you know, chosen to experience before we even got here. All I know, and I'm not going to get into the details of this, but through a near-death experience I had when I was 16, I know from experience, and like to me it's a fact, we're all very powerful beings, the universe individualized in these little bodies. So the kind of possibilities and miracles available to each and every one of us are just like really endless. And my mentor would always have a great question to me when something seemed unsolvable or unsurmountable or like I was, you know, feeling whatever, not my best day. He would turn around and ask this simple question. He'd be like, Estra, what would God do in your place? How would God deal with this? What would God decide to do in this case? And it would just kind of like snap me out of immediately all the kind of, you know, limited habitual ways of thinking I would have. Because I, you know, I wouldn't be crying about the situation. That's definitely, or I wouldn't be blaming myself, or I wouldn't be blaming another. It's a very powerful question. Another very powerful question is, who would I be being if the situation was already solved? What would that look like? What would that feel like? Again, it's a way of like capturing that other reality we want through feeling our way into it. And in terms of the negative emotion that you talked about, I feel that, you know, negative emotions are just so kind of like thrown out the window. But negative emotions I see as messengers to us. And again, when we're super, I don't know, angry or depressed or feeling like a victim or whatever it is we're going through, if instead of sitting in judgment of ourselves or feeling like, oh, other people are doing better, I'm not, why am I here? To turn back around and ask that negative emotion, what is it that you're trying to tell me? Usually those negative emotions are just pieces of our consciousness. It could be, you know, our inner child. It could be kind of stuff that we haven't digested or solved from the past that through whatever event is going on is kind of like raising the finger and asking for our attention. And when we, instead of just dissing it or ignoring it or feeling like it shouldn't be there, if we embrace it, talk to it, try to understand what message is trying to give us or why it's seeking our acknowledgement, then again, kind of miracles can happen from that.
Yes, and I think people have to have some faith that that will happen, because not wanting, you know, the rigidity of not letting go of the past. I was just talking to someone else and saying the same thing that I said to this person, that, you know, in this move, the home that they lived in, they had been in since 1977. And so that's familiarity. That was home. That was where so much of life and family and holidays and everything good and bad, but of course you only remember the good you're letting go of, not the bad that went on. So you're only looking at that part there in the reality you have to let go of, and then go to this new reality that you may not have a choice in this move. It's to an apartment from a 2,800 square foot home to a 968 square foot apartment. But, you know, there's no $1 zillion property tax there. There's no $500 a month snow removal and lawn service there. There's no, when something breaks at the house, which it always does, needing to take the responsibility of finding the repairman and making sure that they're going to do it right and, you know, not mess things up worse. It's a situation where if the person never wants to cook another meal again, three meals a day are provided there. There's a full kitchen, so if they want to cook, they can. But, you know, their choice, if they don't want to cook another meal again in their life, they don't have to. There's an opportunity because of the other people around to be able to do a lot of organized and not organized activities and meet new friends and get new exposures that they never would have had before. And I know it's really hard when you haven't gone there yet.
Yeah.
And you just see that it's not home, it's smaller, it's not this, it's not that. You know, to look at what could be advantageous, I just feel bad in my chair for that, because you'd like people close to you to be able to be happy. And they're entitled to their grief. They're entitled to their feelings. But when you know their attitude is what's hurting them, and that this is their new reality, like it or not, okay, big fat period. This is the new reality, like it or not.
I think it's very, very important what you're saying, Kim, because, you know, that you know, whatever the new reality is, looking at those positive aspects is really, really important. And I think you're really touching on it very nicely through the story. Because rather than what happens to us, how we respond to what happens to us paves the way of what's coming next.
Yes. Yes, and you never know what that's going to be. You know, and I talk about, and then I'm going to go back and ask your questions, but when, you know, when I had my aneurysm and had to leave my career, I had no idea what I was going to do. Had that not happened to me, I probably would have been doing the same job that I did from the day I graduated from college until the day I retired. And my life would have been on autopilot, doing what I knew and making money. That wasn't, that kind of abundance wasn't an issue. And I was perpetually single. I heard those stories that you did when I was younger, and I resented it. You know, in America, every daughter's mother wants them to marry a doctor. Well, that's not going to be so advantageous anymore now that they're on the government payroll. You know, they might as well marry the mechanic, you know, or whatever they're going to do. Not so advantageous. But there was a time when I was young that everybody's mom was saying, you know, you have to marry money, marry a doctor, right? And I always felt very resentful of that. I, you know, one thing about me is I'm an only child. And so I wasn't raised like a, I'm very girly girl, but I mean, I wasn't raised to think I couldn't do something because I was female. You know, I didn't have that difference. You know, I just, I'm Kim, whatever that entails. And so that job, you know, was a commissioned position. Something else I've never experienced is being in the position a lot of people talk about where men or whoever, somebody makes more money than somebody else doing the same job. I was never in that situation because the commission was the commission. No matter what color, what sex, what whatever you were, what you made was based on how hard you worked, because the commission was the same for everybody. So you could be as rich as you wanted or not. You could, you know, you could make it a part-time job and be able to arrange your own schedule. It wasn't punching a clock from 8 to 5, you know, breaks in between and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, if that wouldn't have happened, I never would have stopped long enough to think about the other things that I'd like to do, that I wanted to do, had talked about doing, and then been open to the universe for things I never knew I wanted to do, didn't think I was qualified for. You know, I do photography and have sold it, have had exhibitions, some minor acclaim, you know, published a lot of times doing that. I would have never taken the time to do or try that. You know, I've written 2 books. I never would have done that or taken the time to do that because of one of the books, and I didn't even know what internet radio was. I didn't know it existed. I laugh now and say, I would flip on the old transistor radio and listen to a show called Coast to Coast late at night to put me to sleep, and that was about all I knew about radio. But when I wrote my first book, a lot of traditional radio and then internet radio people were calling me for author interviews, and the person who founded this network, and he's across the country in Spokane, closer to you, we don't know each other. We're half a country away from each other. While I'm writing, he's deciding that he had been doing brain injury radio one night a week for a couple years as kind of a cathartic way for him to work through his transformation. And what he found in doing that was that, my God, much to his surprise, there were people all over the world feeling as isolated and polarized and clueless as he was about what had happened to him and the changes he was going to have to go through. So he was germinating the idea of running brain injury radio 7 nights a week while I was finishing my book and starting these interviews. So he hears me do an interview, gets a hold of me and says what I just told you and asked me if I want to be one of the original authors, hosts. And I said, oh, well, thanks so much, but I'm not do that. I'm really not computer savvy. I don't know anything about radio or broadcasting. Thank you. I appreciate you asking, but I'm not your gal. And he said, okay, and a little small talk, and then he was going to let me go. And he said, before I let you go, he said, were you an author before you wrote your book? No. It was. He got me. He said, and you have a brain injury, right? I said, I do. And he said, you're qualified. What night do you want? And almost 11 years ago, I said, Wednesday, and here I am. And not only that, but I'm our director of operations, and I've hired, recruited, and trained probably 50 other hosts over the time that I've been here as attrition has happened. And so, and I got married, which what I was going to tell you in the back of that thing, and not to a doctor, but I was perpetually single. See, when I wound up doing my life the way I was doing it at the time, actually maybe didn't trust love from some bad experiences, but I also wanted to be empowered to be fully self-supporting on my own contributions and define myself by not being someone's wife or someone's kid. I wanted to know who I was and stretch my wings and see what I could do back before my injury. So I hadn't rushed into marriage. And when I was 45, I thought it might be time to give it a try. and picked somebody who was unlike anyone I had ever dated. I was the bad boy type. Mm. And I married a nice guy. Go figure. but we're a great yin and yang kind of thing. But you see, there's so much of life that everything had to happen exactly the way it happened.
Exactly.
For things to be able to change. You know,
but
if you would have asked
me. Everyone can relate to that, Kim, because I think so many of us, you know, when sometimes we're going through something, it feels like, you know, just all hell let loose and it's an absolute disaster. Yet in retrospect, aspect, when we go back and look at it, we're like, oh, God, thank God it happened this way, or thank God this and this didn't happen. And, you know, how great it would be if we didn't have to wait till after the fact, but be able to find that gift in the middle of the challenge. Because it's always, like, right there sitting. And when we ask those questions, we do touch base with it.
Well,
but what an adventurous life.
Well, exactly. And I'm so grateful, you know. Everything couldn't have happened the way that it did. Then I got a call. This was last week. My cousin sent me a text. He's got a friend who just went to work at the community college here, and there was a non-credit course set up that the instructor backed out of. And my cousin said it's called How to Create Your Own Podcast. He said, are you interested in teaching it? And I said, well, I don't know. Winter's coming, and I won't go into it, but I did break my foot in three places 2 months ago, and I'm still in a boot with crutches. It's not so easy for me to get around, and so I said, can I tele-teach? You know, instead of going to the campus, which is quite a ways away. Well, the answer was yes. And, you know, when I talked to the woman in charge, this new gal here, she's brand new in her job. And they're in a spot because Blur already signed up. The course was in the catalog. The teacher backed out at the last minute. And she finds someone to bring to her boss who's been a podcaster for 11 years, trained 50 other podcasters. And in fact, Craig, who owns our network, also teaches in Spokane in a community college, and he teaches a broad media course that goes a whole semester. But three times I've taught the podcasting section remotely to his class. So an opportunity for me to do something I love and get paid for it.
I love it.
And yeah, and for my cousin Joe to do a favor for this girl and this woman and this woman who's in a brand new job, who's in a pickle. Gosh, you couldn't really, not that I'm so great, but you really couldn't trip on anybody with no notice just by happening to ask my cousin, you know, somebody who's been doing it as long as I've been doing it. And so I'm going to be doing that next month. And that, you know, it's a non-credit course, so it'll just be three times for 3 hours each, you know, but being able to do that kind of thing, and that might amount to something more, and it might not. I don't know, and I don't care at this moment, because when I read in my intro, more will be revealed. It means that before, I thought I had to have the answers to everything ahead of time, you know, to decide whether I was going to do it, the big picture. Well, I don't. You know, I don't. I need to put one foot in front of the other. I can certainly have ideas and goals, you know, I'm not saying not to do that kind of thing, but right now I've been very content with my life, not with what's going on in the world, but with my life, you know, with myself, and this is going to be a cool opportunity to, like I said, do something I like and get paid for it, and meet a new group of people. And who knows, you know, I might wind up being a teacher, you know, and that was never in the playbook either, you know. So you just don't know. And I think it's important to have an open mind and it doesn't mean you have to say yes to every offer that comes by, but it's just if you're so tightly closed with negativity and not wanting to let go of the past, then there's, like you said, there's no room for the light of the spirit, whatever, however you would want to phrase that, to be able to be grant yourself the freedom to move forward and try new things. And I tell people that are listening, you don't have to go into it with an expectation. You mentioned earlier, and I think all of us have gone through some of that we're not good enough stuff. And I, you know, that's when I started really getting good at stuff, when that expectation, when I took it off the table, when I thought that success was measured by how many things I actually got off my ass and tried, rather than thinking about. And whether I was great at it or not great at it, I tried it, and maybe that's not my thing, and I move on to the next thing. But I have that, you know, each one of those was a building block of empowerment to be able to come to the place that was going to help me find, you know, my purpose and my joy. So,
if people should trust what you're saying, that even if it doesn't seem like it, in the bigger picture, all is well. And when we can just respond to life like that, I mean, it's interesting when we look at a mirror every morning. You know, if our face is a mess, we're reflected back a mess. If we're, you know, frowning, we're reflected back unhappiness. If we're smiling, we're reflected back a beautiful smile. And yet when it comes to life, we expect life to reflect things that we're not giving to it, interestingly enough. We expect to maybe be freaking out about money, but expect maybe abundance will come. Or as you were saying, remain attached to the past and then expect something new to show up. And it just doesn't work that way. You know, whatever it is that we're asking for or wanting to be a part of, to ask the question, who would I be being if this was already happening? And to begin to respond to life in that manner. That positive aspect we were talking about in terms of, you know, the friend example you were giving, I mean, just that slight change in perception, which doesn't seem like a big deal, mostly because we don't think perception really matters, it is key in how we pave the way to our next reality. There was a girl who was in our certification course. And, you know, it's not a cheap certification course. So she got a loan, and she's in there. And prosperity-wise, she had $7 besides the loan in her savings account. And when she understood all the stuff that we're talking about with you today, Kim, as you were saying about your friend, you know, just like look at the positive aspects and what a power that has to shift the life around. Because she understood everything we were talking, and really kind of, you know, it's one thing to know something, it's the other thing to be in the consciousness of what you know. Those are two separate different, you know, things. We can intellectually know stuff, but then to let it like come into a cellular level is a completely different story. So she got it. And as soon as her savings account became from $7 to $14, she didn't say, oh, my God, I just have $14. She's like, oh, my God, I just increased my savings by 100%. So as with everything, there's two ways to look at it. Like, oh, I have very little. I have very little house. I have very little love. I have very little health. I have very little money. It doesn't matter. We can either look at it through lack consciousness, or we can look at the same thing in prosperity consciousness. And this girl that I'm telling you about, she ended up increasing her savings to $70,000, like something like 8 to 9 months, and then ended up being able to buy a home. I mean, you know, we teach good. I know that. But it's
yes.
that very perception change that you're also talking about, just a slight change. 7 to 14,
mm-hmm.
hey, I just increased my savings by 100%. That's the I have attitude. The I have, and there is song allows us to attract more of what we're focusing on. The I don't have, it's not good, there isn't enough, takes away even what we had, because that's how quickly the reality responds back to us. So I just wanted to share that.
I'm glad you did. That everything is spot on. So we did talk about where you were before and where you are now in terms of prosperity. Let's see. I was going to ask you about someone learning to identify ego. How do you suggest someone learn to identify ego?
Well, one quick way I can say it is mind chatter. Ego is kind of that mind chatter when we're just like, just kind of talking over and over about, like, just get caught in a thought or a story in our heads. That's just the belief system. That's just yapping away in our minds. That's one way to look at ego. We do have a very different approach to ego, so I don't know if I can express it all in a short time. But, yeah, mind chatter. When we're in the mind chatter, we can know we're in our ego, especially, like, you know, when it's all yapping away in negativity, because ego can be positive, too. It can yap in a positive way, too. But especially when it's yapping in negativity, not to take the mind chatter that seriously, and definitely not to identify the self with the mind chatter.
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, when the mind chatter is going on, I can get a good idea. But to me, I define mind chatter as chaotic. And a lot of time there's not continuity in thought, you know, when you're going 1,000 miles an hour, sometimes that will steep you in the negativity we talked about, or I'm more systematic and not so hamster wheel when I'm plotting out something that's positive. Like, what is the role of our ego in the transformation process? For me, depending on how, you know, I kind of define that a couple ways. I'm big into acronyms. I had the HOW acronym. Ego, in my case, is easing God out. And when I am too much into ego, and in my case, God, whoever else's case, I'm fine with whatever that might be, is that I need to make room to know that I'm not the one. I'm very instrumental in the course my life is going to take, but I'm not going to be as successful doing it alone and thinking that I've got all the power. When I don't ease God out and realize that other people are going to be part of this puzzle I'm putting together, my mentors, my supporters, my helpers, those are the people that are going to help me find my bliss, my success, my transformation. How do you mean it in your case, the role of ego in the transformation process?
I think we define it, we're defining it differently. For me, ego is just a function, and it has the function of anchoring in whatever it is that we've chosen to believe so that it can be experienced as a reality by us. So it's kind of like, let's say, so in that sense, like, ego is neither good or bad. It just does. It's like a loyal soldier, whatever you told it to believe. So that can become your experience until you change your mind about it. So in that sense, the ego is a
is
kind of A, loyal. B, it's a very big protector. And I want to tie this into abundance. For example, I had a friend I was talking to where she does life coaching in Turkey about different subjects. And she was like, you know, I've just gone to so many workshops about abundance, you know, and I just cannot figure this out. Like, no matter what I do or don't do, it feels like I just have just enough, never less, but just enough to get by, just enough for my needs to be met. And she's like, I just cannot figure this out. And I'm like, well, are you sure that, you know, instead of looking at it of like, oh, I'm trying and it's not happening, oh, I can't, I'm not understanding, I'm not learning, can you please look at it possibly as maybe you're getting exactly what you're choosing? And she was like, well, don't be ridiculous. I mean, I want it. And I'm like, really? Okay. Do you want to put it to a test? So she's like, fine, yeah, let's put it to a test. So I got her to close her eyes, and I put her into this picture where, she, you know, she's very prosperous. She doesn't have to work for money anymore. She only works because it's an inspiration for her. She has investments, this and that, and just, like, you know, played that whole, like, scenario. And, of course, she started sweating in front of me. Like, she's just sweating. There's these sweat beads coming off her forehead, and she's taking off her jacket. She's like, oh, my God, it's just getting so hot. And I'm like, what are you feeling? She's like, oh, my God, I just feel all this shame. And I'm like, ah, interesting. So let's go a little deeper. What is the shame about? What is the belief system that's creating the emotion of the shame, that is creating, you know, the money situation to be exactly as is? And she just thinks about it for a second. And, of course, we found it through the emotion, though. And she goes, oh, she's like, oh, my God, I believe that if I have more, others will have less because of me. So if you have a relationship to abundance because of whatever you experienced in the past and your script is, because maybe your mom said so, maybe your dad said so, maybe that, you know, through what you observed, that's the conclusion you came to. But if you have an understanding that prosperity is a, you know, kind of like a lacking commodity or a limited commodity, and you have come to believe, oh, if I have more, others will have less because of me, well, the ego is going to protect that. So
yes,
the part of her that's not allowing, although she wants it, although she's going to the courses, but the part of her not allowing her to manifest the prosperity is the part that believes she'll be a bad person if she has more than what she needs. So the ego is very powerfully going to protect that. How? By not letting her manifest it. So in that sense, it's just an anchor, the function of an anchoring down what we believe so that we can experience as a reality until we wake up from whatever script we wrote and we're like, oh, my God, you know, that's ridiculous. Like in my case, I'm like, oh, my God, you know, I've been broke till my mid-30s because a seven-year-old conclusion about money, like love and money don't go together. I had two beliefs. The other one was like, oh, all the bad people have money and the good people don't care about money. That was another compounding one. Well, a seven-year-old is managing my money life. When I woke up to how ridiculous that is and said, oh, I'm not choosing to believe that anymore, then I was able to create something new. But as we're creating something new, since the ego is all about protecting the old, it will fight us and there will be some conflict. Because,
yes,
you know, it's just trying to protect the old. And if we can understand that, then we don't get into a judgment or feel like something's going wrong or whatever when that conflict begins to happen. It's normal. The ego's going to try to protect the old.
Yes, yes, definitely. I concur with that. that sounds like it would be one of the most important messages in the book, but what do you feel is the most important message in this book, the takeaway that you'd like people to know? And maybe if you can incorporate with that a little bit, or just slide into the title of the book, because the money does grow on trees, because I think you're right. In the beginning, people are thinking you're going to give a 1, 2, 3, 4, these are the four things you do, like a Zig Ziglar kind of thing, you know, to tell people how they're going to do it. And that's not the way it is. I get what it is, but why don't you tell us in your own words the takeaway that you would like people to have, one of the most important takeaways, and how you came to title your book Money Does Grow on Trees?
Yeah, I came to title it that way because through my own journey, through watching my husband's journey and then all our clients' journey, no matter where their limitations are prosperity-wise, I see that all those limitations are always, always in our minds. To me, prosperity is like oxygen. You know, it's available to all. Some of us choose to breathe deeply and get all that oxygen in, and nobody has less oxygen because we're breathing properly. And some of us don't, you know, allow it, and that's fine too. I mean, if the person is happy with what's going on, that's great. But I think the message for me of this book is don't look for a solution. Learn to be the solution. Learn
yes.
to be the solution. That's my intention with this book, and that's why I put a lot of exercises in there as well for the ones that really want to go down that rabbit hole of discovery.
Yes, and I think that's very important. Again, it's in the program notes, everybody, but if you're coming in late, I'm speaking with Ezra Ogut, and her website is IkeandEzraNow.com. You can get the book in all the usual places, but to learn more about their program and what they're doing, make sure to check out the website. Now, we talked some, I think, about prosperity consciousness. Do you advise people to dream big?
We usually advise people, yes, to dream big, but not to mix the dream with the goal. The goal should be the dream broken up into little pieces. For example, if we want an increase in our prosperity, you know, when sometimes people come to the certification program, which is also, you know, a program for them to work on themselves, essentially, and it's like, well, my goal is I want to make $1 million. And it's like, okay, well, how much are you making now? $2,000. Yeah, it's like, no. You know, like, have that dream eventually. I mean, can it happen? Does it happen? Yeah. But that's not a good idea. It's not a good place to start. It's like, you know, if you're going to jump from the bottom of the stairs to the very top instead of walking, you're going to fall flat on your face. And the same is true for goals. They should be a little beyond our reality. Not so far away that it feels impossible, but definitely not inside the box either. Just an amount that brings us maybe 70% like excitement, 30% fear. That's like a good way to gauge a goal. If it's 70% inspired, 30% or 40% there's fear, that's an indication that that's a great goal. Why the inspiration? Well, if we're making $2,000, let's say, and this can go for any goal, it can go for like losing weight as well, and then our goal is $1 million or losing 50 pounds, we're not even going to feel inspired because even our ego doesn't believe it's possible. And
yes.
if there's zero fear, that means we're choosing something too inside the box, too safe. We're not shaking the cage of our current box. So that fear element is good. The ego always freaks out when we're stepping outside our own limitations. So in that sense, it's a good thing to be a little bit afraid.
Yes, I agree. I think that's really good advice. Not going beyond, but not reaching high enough. You talk a lot about being rather than doing. What is a being choice?
A being choice, the mirror example I gave before, I think, is a good image to kind of think about it with. But a being choice is a decision that we make, not just with our intellect, but with all of our being. And when we make such a choice, a new choice to belong to a new reality, but really like on a cellular level, it's a choice. And I'm going to give an example to try to express the vibration of it. But when we make a new being choice, it's like putting a seed on the ground. For sure, it's going to grow. Mm-hmm. And the universe, the rain and the sun is going to help it grow. A being choice is like deciding to get pregnant, you know. And once you decide you become pregnant, then you don't have to worry about how that baby is going to grow. It's going to grow. And when we make a new being choice, then the universe begins to conspire to prepare that reality for us. So when I wanted to come to the U.S., when I had this burning desire to come to the U.S. since I was 16, you know, my parents didn't want me to go. They couldn't really afford, you know, a whole, like, UCLA type of school. And so I just kept them, like, dreaming, wanting. And I finished university in Istanbul and started working in a TV station. And I'm just like, you know, it's going well. I'm making okay money. I'm learning new stuff. But one day I just like got up and to get some coffee. And it's like my whole life kind of flashed in front of me. And I'm like, do I really want to like be in Turkey for the rest of my life? No. Does my soul resonate with the culture of Turkey? No. Have I given up going to America? No. And at that moment, from the time that I started filling my cup till the cup was full, I just made this what we call being choice. You know, it was just with all my heart and soul. I'm like, you know what? I am going to America. I had no money. I had no permission. I hadn't been accepted to UCLA. Even if I was accepted, I, you know, there's no way I can afford hundreds and thousands of dollars. So there's absolutely no, you know, logical way that I'm going. But when you make that being choice, it's like a shift. It's let's say the train is going on specific tracks and all the stations it's going to hit are, you know, obvious. But then when the train tracks change, all of a sudden, wow, you're going a different direction. And you're definitely going to be stopping at different stations. So once I made that being choice, you know, I again started researching UCLA. And all of a sudden, I saw that there's a certification program. So while the actual program costs hundreds and thousands of dollars, the certification program, which is 2 years, was costing $7,000 at the time a year. I'm like, oh, my God, this is so doable. But you see, I didn't have that solution, although I looked a zillion times before I made that being choice. When I was in the wanting state rather than the actual choosing state, I didn't match up with that solution. I didn't match up with that information. So then as soon as I saw that, of course, it looked so doable. So my next thing is, okay, where do I find the money? And all of a sudden, again, when we're out of the victimhood, out of the wanting, when we belong, when we choose to belong, all the solutions start coming. And I was like, oh, my God, I could ask this company to sponsor me, my TV station, to sponsor me to study TV, you know, TV and movie making in UCLA. Now, American companies do that kind of stuff. Turkish companies never do that kind of stuff. It's like unheard of. Like nobody ever asks the company, you know, to be sponsored for school. Like it's just a concept that's not there. Yet I was really adamant. Wow. So I waited for an interview with the, you know, head of the company for like a month. I prepared my speech every single day for a month, like how I'm going to convince, what arguments I'm going to use. The day came to, you know, put on the table the smart idea of mine. And, you know, the person that I had been waiting to see for 30 days, I walk into the office and he goes, you know what? You have exactly 30 seconds to say what you're going to say. I'm going to a funeral. And I just,
wow.
Well, I decided I'm studying at UCLA for certification program. It's, you know, $7,000, and I think you should pay for it. Thank you so much. And I just left. You know? I was like, what? He's like looking at me completely, you know, floored. He's like, is she like crazy or what?
Hey, that was in the 30-second time frame.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that wasn't, he was just like, he had his briefcase. He was already walking out, you know, the door. But because I made that being choice, because without realizing, I didn't know what it was called at the time, but I was actually visualizing for 30 days while I was preparing the speech, really. So all this energetics
right.
had gone towards it actualizing rather than it not happening. Solution was
yes.
coming. The practice was there. So although I made no sense to this guy, and logically he should have like totally not, you know, it doesn't even, the concept doesn't even exist. 3 weeks later, he called me back to the office and he's like, here, we're giving you, you know, the amount for the first year, $7,000. And I was like, oh, what?
Sweet.
And yeah, so that's how a being choice works.
Yeah, I believe that. Very, very cool. So because I asked you a lot of questions earlier, I'm going to rattle off some questions a little bit quicker. What is a transformational coach?
You know what? It's the name we gave ourselves because everybody told us that worked with us. They're like, don't call yourselves life coaches. What you do is like different. So we're like, okay, well, what
mm-hmm.
should we call ourselves then? Oh, okay, transformational coaches. Because transformation happens. I mean, it's just a you know, just the label.
I do like that. Their life coaches seem to be a lot of them right now, and different ones represent different things. You know, some are about business. Some are about personal development, specific pigeonholes. And I like the transformational coach because you're able to do all of those things that the life coaches that are pigeonholing are doing by what you're doing in making an overall transformation in thought process
to
get there. So I think that's cool.
What's different, Kim, is, you know, we had such a great mentor, Daryl Rutherford. I want to say his name here. He passed in March 2020, actually a week after I finished the book, at age 97.
Oh.
Yeah, and
oh,
he was working
goodness.
Right until the end. 98. And
wow.
He was doing coaching since the 1950s. So imagine that, like before this whole coaching concept even existed. And what I'm most grateful to him for is he was such a coach that he never gave us the answers. He would ask
mm-hmm.
us questions until we found our own answers. And that's very,
mm-hmm.
very empowering. So I think sometimes life coaching, and maybe some people do it that way, I'm not sure, but like somebody telling you what to do or like how to be, I mean, I don't know if that's, you know, what other people do, but, you know, even if somebody sees your problem, even if somebody can see your solution, unless the person themselves finds it, it's never that empowering. It can easily come through
mm-hmm.
one ear, go out the other ear. So I just want to honor him here for that. I mean, not being a victim. And he was a great teacher because sometimes he would be like, I don't know, Esra. I don't know the answer to that question. What do you think it is? Who would you be being if this was already solved, you know? Or just these great questions that would kick you out of the old reality and get you married into the new reality, and you would feel like you're just all doing it on your own because he was such a great space holder.
Yes. It sounds like you are very blessed to have him as a mentor, and I think that that does, when you're forced to think of the answer yourself, it's kind of like back to where I was talking about working for citizenship versus stealing citizenship, you know, instead of somebody giving you the answers, which, how does somebody else really know your answers? You know, they can speculate and probably come closer than we can sometimes, but ultimately that answer is going to come from within us. And if we're forced to think about it and to do the way he taught, then it's our idea. It comes from us, and it's going to have more credibility with us, I think. So what a great man to lead you down the path of posing the right questions and allowing you, you know, it wasn't like there was no drop net. You know, he was there, he was the mentor, but he was laying out a plan of transformation that empowered you because you had to work at it and find those answers yourself. So bless him that he did what he did and that he lived as long as he did. I'm sure he helped a lot of people.
Oh, he did.
And gave that gift to you.
Yes. He was a master at making sure your ego, meaning the old reality and all its, like, you know, holding on to the old reality, doesn't get in the way. So when you would come up with your story or whatever, he would just be like, yeah, you know, I'm not really believing what you're saying right now. And he would just do it so at the right moment, you're like, oh, my God, I don't believe what I'm saying right now either, you know. And you just, like, pop out of it.
Wow. I'm glad that you mentioned him. He was just coming up. I was going to ask you about mentors, and then I was going to ask you, a lot of people talk about, do you have a daily spiritual practice? And then I know that you're involved in Kundalini yoga. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested or turned on to Kundalini yoga, and if you have a daily spiritual practice.
Oh my God, the Kundalini yoga was quite a journey. It came to my life way before Daryl and way before the, you know, coaching his mentorship started. I was, you know, in LA doing all kinds of jobs just to be able to, you know, be at UCLA, working for free in the movies, and then, you know, selling shoes to pay rent and all that kind of stuff. And it kind of was not going very well. You know, the American dream was kind of like, you know, crashing on its face at the time. And I was just in a like state of feeling very depressed. Because it was just such a sacrifice to come here, feeling kind of alone, feeling not supported and all these things. And I was doing drugs and I was drinking like crazy and just, you know, kind of like contemplating, well, do I want to be here? Do I not want to be here? I don't think I want to be here, you know, meaning the planet. And there was just this one day, and I love that thing, you know, ask and it is given. It's so true. There was this one evening as I was going to sleep that I said, you know, my life cannot possibly go on like this. This is not the way I'm choosing to live anymore. I'm not going to be like, into drugs, into alcohol, and then depressed, and then just like, you know, live like this for 40 years. This is just not going to happen. You know, if this is going to be the way it is, then I'm just choosing out. Forget it. I can't deal with this. So either this has to change tomorrow or that's it. And I remember being very, very kind of clear. The next day as I was walking around, I see this building, and it has all these, like, kind of red bricks. And for some reason, I got attracted to the building. And I walked right in and opened the door to see what's going on. And there was a Kundalini yoga class that was taught by Gurmukh Kaur Khalsa, who's actually very well known in the community. At the time, she wasn't, I don't think she was known. I mean, I didn't know her. So we're talking about the year 1998 or 1999. So I did my first class, and I cried like a baby throughout the whole class. And I couldn't believe how much emotion, how much kind of sense of stuckness I was able to release from my body in just an hour and a half long class. And as soon as the Kundalini yoga plus the meditation and then as the relaxation was over, I remember stepping outside and I was just flooded with this new kind of sense of hope, this understanding. My biggest decision and understanding was like, oh my God, what am I trying? Am I crazy trying to like carve out a career in Hollywood? There's just so much in me that needs healing. There's just so much in me that's like undiscovered, unhealed. I got to go on a journey of healing. So I just kind of, you know, just I completed school, but in terms of like working in the industry, I'm like, you know what, forget Hollywood. I'm going to go on a journey to heal. And within 3 months, all depression, all kind of addiction completely left. You know, it was just gone. And it was almost like effortless. And now in retrospect, I realize that as I increased my vibration, everything that didn't belong to that vibration had to just fall off. And the alcohol and the drugs and the depression was up. So I was really depressed. And after the Kundalini yoga, that's why then I was very inspired to teach it to others. You know, of course, I had sometimes lows, sometimes highs, but those levels of depression where one is unable to get out of bed, I never again experienced it after Kundalini yoga.
Wow. So I do want to say real quick, because I need to, if you have another 10 or 15 minutes, do you have another 10 or 15 minutes?
Well, my husband is waiting for me to sit at the dinner table, but I could.
Okay.
Well,
all I was going to say to anyone listening, the show in its entirety plays back on demand without any pause. She does have dinner coming. So what I can do is have Ezra back another time. I do think, again, her book, Money Does Grow on Trees, I highly recommend that you check out her book and also check out she and her husband Ike's website, IkeandEzraNow.com, and you can hear more about abundance, how to attract the positive energy into your life, how you can have control over those things and eject the negativity. Again, I think Ezra just made a really good point. It isn't like we go through any of this process and life suddenly becomes perfect and without challenges. That doesn't happen. It's how we handle them. And I think inherent in this transformation and spiritual practices and things like the Kundalini yoga, obviously, maybe not to everybody, but obviously are going to be more enlightening than things like alcohol, drugs, self-harming, other routes that people take that lead to the darkness where the light just doesn't penetrate. And the ability to go through that transformation into something beautiful, you really shortchange yourself. Not a judgment, just an observation, because I went down that road too. So, you know, that wasn't a place that I wanted to be either. And next month it'll be 34 years that I haven't been on that road. Also got involved in some yoga, not to the extent that you did, but she went on to teach it in Turkey. The book will tell you, I'm sure, a little bit about that. And we've talked about the traveling and the different cultures. Just going to see. Tell me, as long as he's waiting for dinner and he's probably listening, what's it like working with your husband?
Oh, my God.
And then we'll wind it up.
Yeah, that is just the best. I swear to you, that is the best. Because actually, we started, like, separately. You know, our lives changed through our mentor, like, within the first 2-3 years of working with him. But, like, in a big way, it started shifting, you know, prosperity-wise, self-confident-wise, opportunities coming, beginning to come our way-wise. But I was the first one who kind of jumped in the pool of coaching. And it was basically like a friend of mine who just, you know, pretty much forced me to coach her. And then from her, it expanded to other people. So I just found myself working as a life coach. And I had my own clientele. Then my husband started. He had his own clientele. And we're like, oh, my God, what would it be like if we worked together? And we didn't know how it was going to pan out, but from our very first thing that we did together, a workshop, we just became inseparable. And there's just something that happens, like an alchemy of sorts, when we're together. I mean, people, you know, love him, you know, love my work individually, and, you know, different people resonate with different people, obviously. But when they come to workshops or certifications, they always say, like, together it's something else, and we feel that too. We just both feel more enhanced, way more enhanced somehow when we do it together. So it's beautiful.
Beautiful, too. That's really cool. My husband and I are like that in a different way, but it's really good when we can be interdependent, you know, not codependent, but interdependent.
Yeah.
And a lot of times things that are my strengths are maybe not what he's as strong in, and vice versa. And you put those two things together and it's a really cool workable package, and also really a blessing, I think, to be able to get the opportunity to do that. So my hat's off to both you and I. I've already mentioned the website. I am going to let Ezra go eat dinner. As it turns out, we really did talk about the majority of the questions in our conversation. And I think what we talked about at the beginning, we do stream to all 50 states and 49 countries. But I think, you know, some of what we talked about that wasn't planned at the beginning was particularly poignant and important coming from you.
Hmm.
Beyond
that,
your book is great. You know, your book is great. What you guys are teaching is great. And so one of the questions on here is, do you have any upcoming trainings, seminars, or events? You can answer that, but I would assume your website might talk about that. Is there one coming soon, or should people check the site?
That's a great question, Kim. That's a great question. Mm-hmm. I think the best way for people, they can get the book from Amazon. That's where it's sold. It's not on the website, the book. For people with who this resonates with, if they want to, like, be a part of either the products that we sometimes have out or workshops that we will do, the best thing is to come to the website. And if it's resonating with you, to give your email. And whenever we organize something, you'll know about it. We haven't yet planned something in the U.S.
Okay, great. For some reason, I don't know if your mic just muted, but we quit hearing you. And it could be because we're maybe going over time. I'm pretty sure that they can still hear me. But I just want to thank Ezra again for being my guest tonight. Again, this was Ezra B. Ogut, and you can check out her website at IkeAndEzraNow.com. That is written down in the program notes posted all over social media or on my site, inaflash.org, or braininjuryradio.com. In about a half hour, you can go back and listen to the show on demand from then, anytime on in the future. I encourage you to do that. I've really enjoyed this interview tonight. And the book, again, is called Money Does Grow on Trees. And it's not at all what you would expect, but I think it's something that you will really appreciate. Ezra, have a great dinner. Ike, I'm sorry for keeping her away from dinner. I hope that you can heat it up and that you guys have a great dinner. And audience, I will be back next week. I hope that you guys all have a great week. And I'm going to close with Rescue, who happens to be from another country. He's from Italy. And this song is called You're My Star. Good night and God bless everyone. Appreciate you being here and your support.
Forever live.